Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:37 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is November 2nd, and today was the Fed meeting, and the Federal Reserve raised rates by 75 basis points, and they said in very plain language they're not done. And I was quite clear yesterday in stating that I believed it was going to be a hawkish meeting, that I didn't believe there was really any credence to be put into this speculation that we were about to have a big pivot. And there were a couple of things that Jay Powell said I think were particularly noteworthy. The first is that they have looked at how fast they've raised rates already. So they kind of think perhaps that they're now at the point where they've started to catch up, and they might even slow down the pace of hikes. But that they still think that the terminal rate, how high they're eventually going to raise rates, is probably higher than a lot of people anticipate. So that's pretty hawkish. But then he came out and said something even more hawkish, because what he said was, and it makes sense, but it's not the kind of news that investors wanted to hear. He said that the risk of over-tightening is a lot less than the risk of under-tightening, that they have the tools necessary to deal with over-tightening. But if they under-tighten and allow inflation to become entrenched, well, then that's something that's going to be an even bigger problem later. But then somebody asked him, well, is it still possible to have a soft landing? And he said, well, the window for that is narrowing, but it's still possible. And I think that we could only describe that as a tongue-in-cheek statement. There's no way it's possible to have a soft landing when you are raising rates so aggressively. And the Dow Jones, having been up in early trading and up actually immediately after the 75 basis point hike, reversed the advance. We've got a downside Q reversal from the region of the 200-day moving average. And this is very similar to the kind of downside key that we had back in April. We didn't have the downside key in August, but we did have downward dynamics subsequently. Now let's just look at this on a weekly basis. The Dow Jones has held up better than both the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 because it's more defensive. And a major health insurer like United Health is the largest constituent at nearly 10% of the index. Apple, which is a much more cyclical stock, is down around a weighting of, I think it's like the 14th largest company on the Dow. So it's certainly more defensive. But we're also looking at the very clear reality that a recession is inevitable, and a recession will hit corporate profits. So we've seen corporate profit expectations being downgraded, but they've not been underperforming those downgraded opinions. But that's inevitable if we have a recession. So then let's just think about what's the winning strategy in a secular bull market. Buy and hold is the number one strategy that works. And when you're buying and holding, your anticipation is that prices will move to new highs following occasional periods of inactivity. So you'll be rewarded for holding on, even through periods where the stock isn't doing much, or even after a decline. And if you want to make the best of a buy and hold strategy, well, then you'll also get ready to buy the dips. So that's a doubling down on buy and hold. If you buy the dip, well, then what you're willing to do is to bet even with more, I think, commitment that prices are going to rebound and you will be rewarded for your resolve. And in a secular bull market, that is always the most rewarding strategy, because in a secular bull market, occasional periods of inactivity will be rewarded with higher prices later. So then, when buying the dip stops working, then that is about the clearest indication that we can have that the secular bull market is really under threat. So we've seen multiple occasions over the course of the last 14 years where Reversions back to the region of the 1,000-day moving average have been really favorable buying opportunities. And then, of course, we had the big decline in 2020. And we'll often see that a big trend will lose consistency at the penultimate high. So that's basically what we had. Then the market re-upped and moved up in a really spectacular manner. And now we've had multiple occasions where rallies have been shorting opportunities. We had the attempt to buy at the region of the 1,000-day moving average in June, and then it failed, moved to a new low. It came below the 1,000-day moving average and has popped back up to the region of the 200-day moving average, and now it's failing again. Downside follow-through tomorrow will confirm the signal. Now, when we think about the Nasdaq, it did not rally to nearly the same extent. And instead, on this occasion, what we have now got evidence of is resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So we have never seen the Nasdaq do that. All the way back to 2009, there has never been an occasion when it encountered resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So the logical conclusion is that the Nasdaq is further along to breaking its secular trend. And if it can't push back above the 1,000-day moving average within the next couple of weeks, then it has certainly broken the secular trend. And that is very much supportive of the view that technology is going to go through a period of significant underperformance. Now, it doesn't mean that every stock in the Nasdaq will go down, but then we're going to start seeing that ETF holdings are going to start getting liquidated, and the largest companies will be hit hardest. So this is why the Fang Man plus Tesla shares are underperforming the wider market, and their market cap is breaking clearly down through the 1,000-day moving average. Now, when I first created this ratio a couple of years ago, I was very clear in stating that the secular bull market would not end until this ratio broke downwards. Well, this ratio is breaking downwards. The secular trend is over. I think we have to be willing to reach that conclusion based upon the price action that we're seeing right now. Then let's just think about how the bond markets are performing. So 10-year yields were hovering around 4% earlier on in here today and then firmed. So up about 5 basis points. Still in a really quite consistent bull market, extending the breakout above the 3% level. This remains a market where it's logical to anticipate there will be additional upside. But bond yields will not rise indefinitely. So when we look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet, it is really only just starting to come back down. Now, it's quite normal to anticipate that yields will rise at the beginning of a quantitative tightening program, because the Fed is selling bonds and that overwhelms available buyers. So that is going to have a knock-on effect. It's also worth considering that the convexity of the bond market is much higher at low interest rates than it is at high interest rates. So it means that as yields rose from almost 0 or 1% to 4%, that was where some of the fastest selling pressure occurred in bond markets. But the move, because that's a move from 1% to 4% of hundreds of percent, then the move from 4% to 6% is a move of 50%. So then the sensitivity to interest rates is not as great. Now, it does not mean that bond prices will suddenly rise, but a lot of the selling pressure has already happened in the bond market. So when then we get to a point where economic activity does roll over and unemployment is rising, and investors are now more, are then, I guess, more interested in deflationary forces. That's when then yields will collapse. So it's, and it, this is exactly what we saw when the Federal Reserve did its quantitative tightening between 2018 and 19, and yields went up first and then collapsed afterwards in 2012 through 2014, when the ECB took €1 trillion out of circulation. Yields went up first, down afterwards. So it's quite likely that's exactly what we're going to see on this occasion. But then the big difference on this occasion is the number of open jobs. And I think this is a longer term problem, and I don't think that it's going to be addressed easily. So there are more than 10 million open jobs, and it's not so much the absolute figure that's important, but rather the trend, because the trend has been rising now for the last 13 years. But the early part of that trend was the recovery from the global financial crisis, and then it leveled off between about 2015 and 16. And then President Trump won the election. The Trump tax cuts were very pro-cyclical in nature, so that was a really significant event. Then what we had was a big jump in economic activity, and the number of open jobs increased and subsequently decreased during the pandemic. Then massive money printing and waves of people that decided, with high asset prices and the threat to their health, that they would take retirement. So unemployment at the 65 and overs level is now in excess of 13%. On top of all of that, the more ambivalent attitude towards immigration that started in really took off with President Trump's presidency has removed the flow of new workers into the US economy. So that has contributed to the uptrend of open jobs. If the Fed is going to rebalance the economy, then they're going to have to shave 10 million jobs out of the economy before they even begin to address the unemployment rate. Now, of course, there's a mismatch between people that are working and the open rate, so it's not going to be a one-for-one scenario. But it's going to be difficult to bring down the inflation rate without the number of outstanding jobs or open jobs also starting to come back down. But then we can think about savings as a percentage of the disposable income, because it's now back to where it was in 2008. So that big swell of savings that occurred during 2020 has basically all been spent. Then where are people getting the money? This is if we think about, and I'm not sure this is the correct chart, but the demand for credit has been rising, so people are buying more, I'm going to see if I can find the. Because I was looking at a different one earlier on today. I will post the correct chart in comment of the day today. But demand for revolving loans has been rising precipitously over the course of the last year and a half. So there's lots more demand for credit cards. Well, when you have spending that is keeping pace with inflation, then people have to find the money from somewhere. And if they have sold or they've spent their savings and they're now spending on credit cards, and interest rates are rising, and liquidity conditions are tightening up. And then let's think about the financial conditions. And they're also tightening up pretty considerably. So this isn't as tight as it was in 2020, but it's not dissimilar to how tight it was at major lows in 2018, and it is quite likely that it's going to get considerably tighter from here. So we're nowhere near yet the kind of tightness in the economy that's going to really have an impact on consumer behavior, and that also contributes to the real scope for additional weakness in economic activity and lower equity prices overall. Now let's think about some of these commodities. So gold prices were up in October. They were higher in here today and then reversed the advance as the dollar rebounded. So there is certainly the potential here that gold prices will be under pressure. Now we've seen that the buying of gold from sovereign countries has increased substantially this year, and it's at the highest level in decades, and it's being led by countries like Turkey because they have basically made it a law that they're going to buy all of their domestic production. So that's been one of the factors that helped to support prices. But the dollar index continues to march higher. And it bounced from the 110 area last week. It's following through on the upside in here today. So there's certainly been some softening up. We've had three downside key reversals in the space of a month. There was hope that this might have been the peak in the dollar. But this has been a big move and a big upside day, and more importantly, an outside day in here today. And it's confirming support in the region of the 110 area, and that improves the potential that the dollar is going to march back up and test the 115 area. So the yen has been steadying over the last week, and it is quite likely that it will weaken through the 150 area tomorrow. The Chinese renminbi has also been steadier over the last couple of days. But it's likely to continue to weaken in here tomorrow. There has been speculation, and there was upside follow-through today in Hong Kong assets on the belief that there's going to be a change to the COVID zero policy. And there's been a lot of speculation with regard to that. I just don't see that as credible. How can they abandon COVID zero when the number of cases are rising? Now, that doesn't mean that they won't abandon it eventually. Of course they will. But they're going to do it from a position of strength, not weakness, because to do anything other than that would be to question the entire rationale of the lockdown in the first place. And the last thing any kind of communist administration is going to do is to allow any kind of doubt in the sanctity of its decision-making process. So I think this is just short covering rallies, and we're going to see additional weakness from Hong Kong assets until we actually get a de facto change to the COVID zero policy. And it is likely that we're going to see stock markets in Europe also come under pressure tomorrow, and not least because the regional currencies are also going to come under pressure. So the FTSE 250 has been rebounding over the course of the last 3 weeks, and it's now in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range. So this is the first area of potential resistance, and I would anticipate that we're going to get at least some pause of consolidation in here tomorrow. And in Brazil, Bolsonaro did not formally admit defeat, but he did instruct his administration to begin the handover and that he was not going to contest the result of the election. So that's positive for Brazil, and it speaks to the strength of the democratic institutions within the country. Handing over of power after elections is something that's absolutely integral to the democratic process. I remember my mother always said that the most important thing that ever happened in Ireland was the first election after the Civil War, that the losers of the election were willing to go into opposition, and that the police force did not rebel against the Republicans who had won the election. And that was the foundation of the democracy. And it's absolutely imperative that within democracies that the handover of power following elections can proceed unencumbered, and that the losers of an election will go into opposition in a forthright manner. And then, of course, there's the entire question about the integrity of the elections, which needs to be protected. And it is very beyond the pale to call into question the integrity of elections. It really does light a fuse under civil unrest. And that's now occurred in the USA as well. So this questioning of the integrity of elections is something that was started following the last presidential election, and it's going to proceed in this upcoming election next week and in the presidential election in 2024. So there are going to have to be measures put in place to help to support the integrity and the belief of people in the integrity of elections going forward. And that's not yet forthcoming, and it will happen eventually, but definitely measures will have to be put in place to support that, or democracies are going to be in a whole world of trouble. And this is, I think, especially important because geopolitical conditions are deteriorating. So when we look at the defense sector, then it is firming within its range. And there's a war going on in Eastern Europe, which is expending a huge quantity of dated material. So that's going to manifest itself later in a desire by all of the interested parties to rearm. And that's a very significant product pipeline for a lot of defense companies. And it's going to represent a significant portion of government spending. So, regardless of what happens, defense budgets are likely to be higher in future. That infrastructure is going to have to be duplicated, and that's going to require additional money. Both of those are very oriented towards government spending. So it's likely that governments are going to play a much bigger role in how capital is allocated after the impending recession. And I think that means that governments are going to have even more power. And that's not a comforting thought for a large number of people. Now, oil prices have been locked in this very tight range between 90 and $100 on Brent crude. Now, let me see if I can get my, there we go, my keyboard to work. So Brent crude has been steadier, and the sales out of the strategic reserve are going to end at the end of this month. So I think investors will be, or traders will be, willing to bet that the balance of probabilities is prices will rally from here. And that's also going to contribute to inflationary pressures. So I think we are not yet out of the period of commodity volatility. And when last week, or I guess on Monday, it looked likely that Russia was going to inhibit the export of wheat, then they signed back up for the agreement today, and wheat prices came straight back down again. So this is a very clear indication of just how much of a geopolitical premium is on the wheat market, and indeed, I think on the oil markets. And then natural gas prices have also been steadier. This is on the expectation for colder weather in North America. And of course, the potential that there will be additional exports heading over towards Europe. So, UK natural gas prices paused mostly over the last week, but still finding support in the region of the 200-day moving average after the contract change. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.